Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre podcast for the 24th of July 2016. My name's TRP Watson, and this week I'm joined by Gareth James, Web Cowgirl, and Paul in London. We're now going to talk about Into the Woods at the Menier Chocolate Factory. This is a fiasco theatre production which was produced off-Broadway in 2014, and we've pretty much got the same cast as we had. This production is directed by Noah Brody and Ben Steinfeld. Noah Brody plays people like Cinderella's Prince, the Wolf, and Lucinda, and Ben Steinfeld plays the Baker. What Fiasco Theatre have done is taken the play and not exactly cut it down, but cut down the fuss of it. It's a 10-member cast, although I think it's slightly bigger here. Originally it was a 10-member cast on Broadway, and they just had a pianist playing on stage. Into the Woods is, of course, a musical with music and lyrics by Stephen Sondheim and a book by James Lapine. It is his take on grim fairy tales. We have probably three central ones plus another couple and others mentioned, but the three central ones are probably Red Riding Hood, Jack and the Beanstalk, and Cinderella. We also have some things from Rapunzel and Snow White and Sleeping Beauty appear in some versions of the musical. It's held together by another story which is reminiscent of a Grimm story. There are lots of things like this, so it might be actually one of the fairy tales that the Grimms collected. And that is the baker and his wife, who are childless and are desperate for a baby until they are told by a witch that if they can collect certain items, they will be able to have a baby. And basically the items they need to collect turn out to be one of Cinderella's slippers, the cow that Jack is trying to sell, Rapunzel's hair, and Little Red Riding Hood's cape. So that's a sort of general idea of how they get into it. But I haven't seen the musical myself. I've watched the movie recently, and I was very impressed. It's a typical Sondheim score, but it's a very accessible one. It's very easy to listen to. There are a few standout songs, but they didn't really live in my memory that effectively, although they are mentioned separately. It's not like something like Company, where people will wheel out Ladies Who Lunch. I think it's the kind of one where people wheel out the songs as standards. But the musical quality, it's fairly typical, I think, of Sondheim. And it's a very strong and a very good example, I think, of his music and why you should see more Sondheim. And certainly I'm very tempted to see this production. Gareth, tell me more about this and what you thought about it.
When I heard it was coming to the Menier, I was kind of wondering, do we need another Into the Woods, really? Because there have been a fair few. I mean, I've seen, I don't know, about eight of them, I think. And quite recently, we had a very good production up at the old Rose and Crown in Walthamstow. But I just think it really does add something. And I was really glad they did bring it over, because I think it's actually a very original, a very different take on the show, really. As you say, the three well-known tales are Cinderella, Jack and the Beanstalk, and Little Red Riding Hood. And then we have then two of the less well-known tales, as you mentioned, the Rapunzel and the Baker's Wife. And we have this search for the items so that the baker and his wife can have a child. This sort of weaves the tales together very cleverly, and when you get to the end of the first act, it's quite a sort of hopeful bit, really. And then, of course, it gets much darker in the second half, because the giantess seeks to get her revenge and things all start going hopelessly wrong. So it's very much darker than you might expect it to be. Although Grimm's tales were originally dark, they've been sort of lightened in subsequent pantos and other interpretations of them. What's great about this production, really, is that it's got a storytelling quality which is really very much in keeping with the material, and it feels more like a play with music than it does musical theatre, because it doesn't have the staginess that musical theatre often has. And that, I think, makes the lighter moments more charming and makes the darker moments deeper. So I think it has quite a big impact. So the style has quite a bit of impact on the story. And somehow the sort of morality of the piece comes over much more strongly than I've seen it before. It is sung and played by a cast of 10 who also play instruments, some of which are proper instruments and some of which are homemade instruments. And then you've got this pianist, Evan Rees, who plays the rest of the score, as it were. So it's Evan Rees on piano, the rest embellishing with these other instruments. It is actually very, very well sung and indeed very, very well played. And I think the group, Fiasco Theatre, their background appears to be in Shakespeare and other kind of storytelling things. And I think that's what they bring to this piece that's very different. They're not musical theatre people putting on a musical. They're theatrical people, storytellers, actors who can sing. And I think that's what makes this show different from other interpretations of Into the Woods I've seen. And I think that Noah Brody and Ben Steinfield have done a terrific job on this adaptation. It looks wonderful. The only other time I've seen the Meunier look quite so wonderful was the Bacharach Reimagined show, What's It All About, when it was at the Meunier and Close to You, when it got to the West End. And the designer, Derek McLean, has done something magical here as well, because he's made what is an intimate space, an even more intimate space, by making a sort of proscenium of piano keyboards and then making side walls out of piano innards, and then a back wall of ropes that are quite deep that represents the woods. And then there are chandeliers above the stage and coming into the auditorium. So it just, as soon as you walk in to the theatre, it looks gorgeous and has this lovely sort of intimate feel and draws you in to the storytelling style of the show. So I thought it was, I think it's a very original musical anyway, and I think this is a very original, very inventive, small-scale take on it. So I was very, very glad they brought it over and enjoyed it very, very much indeed.
We're now going to talk about Some Girls at the Park Theatre. This is Neil LaBute's play, which was premiered in 2005 in London before moving over to Broadway. This particular production is directed by Gary Condes and stars Charles Dorfman, Caroline Backhouse, Ellie Condren, Roxanne Pallett, and Carly Stenson. I would quickly like to mention the cast from the West End in 2005, which is a rather interesting one. It was David Schwimmer, Catherine Tate, Leslie Manville, Saffron Burrows, and Sarah Powell. So that was a pretty strong cast for this play, and especially for a on West End premiere. I'm not sure I remember the play with that much affection, though. Webb Cowgirl, tell me about this production, what you thought about it.
Sure. Well, I can't tell you anything about the previous production because I didn't see it. But I'm a fan of Neil LaBute and the language that he uses and how realistic it is, and the fact that his characters are not prettied up and, to me, represent extremely normal people doing normal things. And apparently one of the normal things that people do is they're jerks to each other, and they can be temperamental and random and just not really act like good people at all. And the lead character of this play, who is just referred to as Guy, as in some guy, is a man whose behavior towards women over the course of his life appears to have been not very good. In fact, it seems that he has walked out on most of the relationships he's had and not said a word to the people that he had been dating about why it was that he was leaving. And I think this is the reason that when he offers these women an opportunity to meet with him and let him make amends, that they take him up on it. But I couldn't understand his motivations. And it's very like a LaBute play for people to behave weirdly. And I felt that the character of Guy didn't really make sense, that the things that he was trying to do didn't tally up. And I'm pretty sure this is how he was written. So I can't blame the actor, but I'm certainly going to blame Neil LaBute for creating this character whose interactions with people seem to be so obscure and not justified by what's presented to us during the show. Charlie Dorfman brings a very nice physicality to his role as the It's not really a philanderer, but the man with a thousand, the traveling man. Yeah, he's like the traveling man of the songs from the '50s. No, rambling man. He's got a girl in every town. But I do actually have a problem with him being cast in this role, because with the number of people that he has had, his character has had extended relationships, this guy should be in his 30s. And he looks like he's about 24 or 26. He's extremely handsome and pretty young. And I would have liked to have seen him look like a slightly past his prime man who's decided at, 38 or 40 that it's finally time to get married. I also would like to have seen Charles give him more of something to make us see more than just a shallow, manipulative loser who is trading off of almost the only talent he has in life to try to become, I don't know, famous or a writer, or, well, I guess a famous writer. I wanted to have that hook into his motivations for why he's been a serial leaver, and a feeling more of his attachment to his writing career. I felt that of all of the characters in this play, the guy was the least believable. And because of that, watching him on stage, the fact that I never was able to connect to his reality, it made it not possible for me to entirely go through the emotional journey that the four women that he's talking to go through when we're watching them on stage. In effect, it almost felt like I was watching an extended version of a sitcom. And because he's able to walk out of every conversation that he has after, 20 minutes or so, I never get to be emotionally vested in any of the other characters on stage. And the lead character isn't really supposed to be likable, and he can't be likable. And if you do like him, then, I kind of, question your own values. But the four women are likable, but they don't get to go into nearly enough depth about their characters. And it leaves us as an audience just skating on the surface of what is almost a bit of a joke waiting for a punchline. The four characters that we get to see are actually pretty nice roles for the women. We have a female professor. We have someone who's sort of billed as a small town girl. We have a wild gal in Chicago and a California beauty in Los Angeles who's a doctor. But each of them form a sketch of a person, but I think that they could get a lot deeper than they do. But because of the way LeBute has formatted this, it's not really possible. So it's a nice show for the four women to get to develop some characters. But overall, as a theatrical experience, I found some girls thin and not really engaging, and I'm afraid that of all the Neil LaBute plays that I have seen, that this is the one that I currently think is least deserving of a revival. And if I had seen this in 2005 instead of seeing Fat Pig in 2008, I suspect that I would not have gone back to be seeing Neil LaBute plays again, because I think that he doesn't know how to create any depth in his characters.
This production of the play has lived in my memory more favourably than the version I saw in 2005. I think that one suffered a little bit from what you often get when you get a West End premiere with star actors in things. The stars can't quite carry it off as well as actors who you don't know particularly well and have no expectations or no prior image of. And I think that that's why, for me, this one worked better. It's certainly the character that Neil Butte's created, this rather obnoxious man who doesn't really know what he wants from life. I think what he's doing is going round trying to find out what might go wrong with his upcoming marriage, because he thinks he's finally found the one, although from what I can see, he's actually marrying a girl who's sort of at least 10 years younger than he is. I think he's supposed to be about 33, so he's obviously found somebody who will put up with his foibles and his rather absent way of being. I was a little bit reminded of the plays Reasons to be Happy and Reasons to be Pretty, where we had the character played by Tom Burke, who was in the same way rather distant and withdrawn, and also turned out to be a writer and a teacher, which is what this character is. But the problem I had with the guy in Some Girls was that he just didn't seem to understand what he had done. He seemed to have to be told by the women in his life how terribly he had treated them. He didn't seem to understand that. And yet, at the beginning of this play, to have written a fascinating short story, a piece of fiction about his relationship with several of these women. In fact, quite a few of the women see themselves in what he's written about. And although he claims to, it gets revealed that he could be writing about his relationships, he doesn't seem to understand them himself. And you do wonder, well, what is he writing about? If he doesn't understand it, how does he write the fiction about it? I mean, surely he has to understand his relationships. As you said, it doesn't quite make sense. There are certain holes with this character, this man, this guy. But certainly the women in this play are much more interesting. I tend to think of them as sort of the girl next door, the sex pot, the older woman, and the one. I actually enjoyed this production a lot and thought a lot better of it than I did back in 2005. And it certainly got flaws, but I did enjoy my stay while I was watching it. We're now going to talk about Proud. This is a play from 2011 by Michael Healy. It's part of the Finbrough's kind of informal season of Saturday, Sunday, Monday plays where they look at some interesting Canadian plays. Fairly recently we had Maggie and Pierre, which was all about the relationship between Pierre Trudeau and his wife Maggie, and their difficult relationship, which in part ended up with Justin Trudeau, who became the Prime Minister of Canada. This play, Proud, written in 2011, just after Stephen Harper had got a proper big majority as Conservative leader in Canada. And the conceit of the play says he actually got an even bigger majority than the one he turned out to get. He got 166 out of about 300. But this posits that actually he gets a much bigger one. So when they try to arrange the House, which is built like the House of Commons in Britain with the two opposing sides, the Conservatives are on one side and they're on about half of the other side as well. The idea here is that instead of getting a fairly large, substantial majority, he gets a massive majority, and it looks as if the Canadian Conservative Party is going to be there forever and ever, and he's going to manipulate it. And we see Stephen Harper as this manipulative person, although of course it's not supposed to be Stephen Harper. There was a little bit of a controversy about that when the play came out, because Michael Healy, who'd done a lot of work with the Tarragon Theatre in Toronto, they actually didn't want to do this play because they felt that it might be libelous and they'd get into a lot of trouble from Stephen Harper. So he did it at another theatre and actually played this Prime Minister. It's not supposed to be Stephen Harper, although it is Stephen Harper. It's one of those situations where, you know, for legal reasons they have to call him the Prime Minister. But for all intents and purposes, he is Stephen Harper, the Conservative Prime Minister of Canada, who was there from 2006 to 2015. And this play likes to think that actually this is how the Conservatives ensconce themselves in Canadian politics forever and become the natural party of government. It's an idea that they revisit over and over again in this play. And it's an imagination of how that might come about with this character who, sometimes he's an interesting and likable person, and he seems a lot more likable than those of us who read The Economist would think of the real Stephen Harper. Stephen Harper was very anti-environmentalism and things like that, and there were some shenanigans about proroguing Parliament and delaying elections that he got up to some years back and involving the Governor-General, which seemed awfully dodgy, but I don't know whether or not that it is entirely the case. I think he is still regarded quite well in the Conservative Party, so perhaps he is as divisive a character in Canada as Margaret Thatcher was in Britain. In this play, what we imagine is they've come in with, as I say, an overwhelming majority, this is almost three quarters of the House, and one of the MPs they encounter is somebody who was in what they refer to as a rotten borough, what they call their constituencies ridings, and she was in a riding that she simply was not expected to win, so they put a pretty much a useless candidate in there, and she comes in, and she appears to be this woman who, well, the first time we meet her, she comes in asking for a condom because she's planning to have sex with a journalist, and they are very worried about her. But they see that her bluntness and her apparent ignorance is something they might be able to use to their advantage. This is the Prime Minister and his Chief of Staff, who's called Carey. The woman MP is called Gisela Lith, which is obviously a comic name, which they have some trouble talking about. And she is kind of somebody who's not really a conviction politician and finds it easy to do things that she doesn't believe. So when she asks for her beliefs, she has a whole load of nots, and she has very few positives in her beliefs other than an entire belief on self-reliance. And it becomes very clear that what they want her for is to put forward bills, to be sort of almost an agent provocateur, somebody who will get all the headlines. It's rather like having, we think of it in terms of British politics, I mean, perhaps like Boris Johnson, somebody who causes an awful lot of trouble, and people can just be shocked and dismiss his behaviour, or hopefully dismiss his behaviour, but all the while saying, go on, keep it up, Boris, because you're doing splendidly. And this is what they do. In order to bury unpopular policies, they get her to put forward a private member's bill, which is a private member's bill about abortion, in order to distract the people away from their unpopular policies, their cutbacks. It's one of the things about the Conservative government of Canada, that they were very much like most Conservative governments, it seems, that they are very big on cutting back the role of the state and trying to minimise it. The idea here is that the only thing the Prime Minister believes in is a figure of 22%, which is his GDP to debt ratio, and that's what he wants to keep it at, and he will cut government until that is what they end up with, which is a fairly boring economic point, and it's a little bit difficult to get across, I think, in this play, but they kind of succeed, and they admit in this play that the economics in this is going to be boring. There is this image we have of the Chief of Staff making the mistake, expressing interest in an economic problem and being lectured about it for the entire time that it takes him to fly from Belarus back to Canada, back to the Prime Minister's front door. The Prime Minister here is extremely into his economics and is able to bore for Canada about it. The problem with this play, as with Maggie and Pierre, is that you really don't know enough about Canadian politics. I mean, I know a little bit about Canadian politics, but that's mainly The Economist telling me that Stephen Harper was a jolly bad sort and that sort of thing. And I don't really know enough about Canada except the view of Canada we get from America, which is all Putin and saying you're sorry, which is not quite the thing you want to know about Canada. But I quite enjoyed this play. I thought it was interesting, but I didn't feel I got all the jokes. And I think if you were of the moment, if you were in 2011, if you were looking at this large Conservative majority and thinking about, well, what if it's a larger one? What if we've got this situation where he's Prime Minister for an extremely large amount of time, which is something they posit in this play, the idea that Stephen Harper might have gone on and on and on. Of course, now we are post Stephen Harper. He's still an MP, but he's a backbencher. He's not even on the front bench of his own party. The Liberals destroyed the Conservative majority in 2015, and we have Justin Trudeau coming on instead. But we do have this rather interesting bit of this dystopian future where Stephen Harper has completely taken over and has ruled for, I think it's about 30 years, so we would be in 2030-odd, and he's still Prime Minister at this point. So it's a frightening thought about, somebody being Prime Minister for that long. And we have this person who turns out to be the son of the MP who is supposed to be used as an agent provocateur. He's being interviewed and talking about it, and we get that. And obviously there was a fear at the time in 2011 that this is a possible future. The cast here is, the Prime Minister is played by Nicholas Cass-Beggs. Carrie Baines, the Prime Minister's Chief of Staff, is played by Jude Monk-McGovern. Gisela Lith is played by Emily Head. I think she's the only Canadian in the cast. And we also have Jake Lith, Smith, who's played by Will Firth. And if you think, ooh, Firth, is it? Is it? Yes, it is. He's the son of Colin Firth and Meg Tilly. He's fairly new to the stage, actually. I mean, he's done a few things, and he's also in the next installment of the Bridget Jones films, if you're really interested in that sort of thing. Paul, what did you think about this play?
Well, thanks, Jim. I think I was a bit like yourself, where I knew there was a politician called Stephen Harper, who at the losing the election last year was seen to be a breath of fresh air when Justin Trudeau took over. And I think Justin Trudeau has certainly got a lot more press, I think, because of his looks, and I think because of his way of doing things, he's been seen as a breath of fresh air. But actually, one of the things which I wished I'd have done before actually seeing this piece was actually brush up a little bit more about politics in Canada, because I think that would help with the appreciation of it. The scene setting of the play is really just to say there was this guy who was the prime minister. What if he actually, instead of winning a small majority, actually won more than anyone could ever imagine? And I think the context, from what I've gathered since seeing the piece, is really that Canada, for many years, the natural party that seems to win office more often has been the Liberal Party. And Stephen Harper actually came in and created a conservative movement out of a bunch of other parties, from what I gather. And that's actually an interesting thing in itself, that actually he managed to create a minority government for many years and kept this coalition of various non-liberal interests together in this party until last year when Trudeau won. But I think what's interesting, though, about this piece is when it gets going, you actually start to understand what it is the Prime Minister actually believes in. And Michael Healy, as a playwright, has been quite devastating in that account. He presents a man that's got a big strategy, but the strategy is just to make government a little bit smaller. And everything else is just window dressing around that. And actually, I thought that was, there's a lot of talk in the notes of the play that when it was first presented, this piece was seen as scandalous and so forth. I actually think it's actually less shocking in that regard, and it's actually much more of a devastating critique of what the playwright feels is a prime minister with a very small-minded vision for the future of the country. And I think that is born too with some of the choice in the program of talking about the politics of fear and division, which is how he sort of kept winning elections, I assume. But I think when you don't know the man, it does actually make the piece a little bit harder to understand. I think the other aspect too is that Stephen Harper, by any accounts, is not like Pierre Trudeau, who coined the phrase Trudeau-mania when he was first elected in the 60s. So, and he actually cut a lot, much broad, bigger figure on the world stage. I think Stephen Harper is probably more of a blip than anything else in world history and events. So I think that's an interesting choice to dramatize as a person. But having said that, I think, you know, it's well acted. I really enjoyed the cast here. I think perhaps one of the things that the role of Gisbella Lith, being played by Emily Head, is difficult to always understand her motivations here. And actually, I was drawing on my own experiences of seeing surprise elected candidates coming from Australia. Pauline Hanson was a divisive character that was actually standing for an unwinnable seat, and then she won it. And she was much more divisive and much more on the right of any political spectrum than this character that's presented here. She comes across towards the end as a woman that's very much knowing exactly what she wants to do, which doesn't actually make it sound plausible from the beginning, because actually she was an accidental candidate, the whole premise is, and that the Prime Minister's playing her along. I also think it probably for a biting satire, it could have actually bitten a lot more. I think it works well when it's really narrowing down on the things that the playwright really thinks that Stephen Harper failed the country on. But when it goes into the sort of sex comedy type things, I think it's a little bit easy territory. Having said that, it's really exciting that the Finborough can present these pieces on its Sunday, Monday, Tuesday sessions. So it gives the opportunity for them to also run a different show during the time when their main show is playing. And I think that it's quite a treat, actually. And while Stephen Harper may not be a figure of historical importance in Canadian history as some of the other leaders that they've had, it's a interesting take on the whole piece, and it's quite well acted from the three of them that are in it.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.